there's not very many Americans, period, who travel to North Korea on an annual basis.
A U.S. travel ban likely for North Korea. It's Tuesday, July 25th. This is VOA Asia. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Hello. We're online right now at VOA Asia Facebook. Join us there as well. Also ahead, questions remain on South Korean abductees, Philippine drilling to restart in disputed waters, closing the math gap in school, long live coffee, and women in tech. It's all on today's VOA Asia. The Trump administration is expected to announce this week a ban on most Americans traveling to North Korea. It comes a month after 22-year-old college student Otto Warmbier died after being released from a North Korean prison and returned to the United States in a coma. Korea Society Senior Director Stephen Norper tells VOA's Victor Beatty this is mostly a symbolic reaction.
There's not very many Americans, period, who travel to North Korea on an annual basis, probably 1,000, 1,500 at most. The ban is largely symbolic. The Congress and the administrative branch felt that they needed to move forward in terms of some sort of response on the tragic death of Otto Warmbier. So this is a State Department action that's designed to really convey a message that what happened to Otto Warmbier and the concern about the three Americans who remain in detention are such that American tourists can't travel now. Once that's announced this week, there'll be about 30 days until it takes effect.
This comes as a national security forum in Colorado was taking place, and a couple of interesting comments from U.S. officials. The CIA director, Mike Pompeo, strongly hinting the U.S. may consider seeking regime change in North Korea. He said Thursday night President Trump ordered him to come up with options that would, quote, separate the capacity to build and deliver nuclear weapons from, quote, someone who might well have intent. He was notably ambiguous. What do you think?
Well, clearly they're trying to indicate once again that all options are on the table. And it appears that Secretary of State Tillerson's comment about there not being pursuit of regime change seems to be in somewhat conflict with what Mike Pompeo says in terms of, or at least hints of, in terms of regime change. So we don't know what to make of it other than to simply acknowledge that there is a range of options that include everything from the preferred means of economic tightening and enhanced sanctions to perhaps more drastic measures.
On Saturday, the chairman of the U.S. Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Joseph Dunford, told the same National Security Conference while he preferred a diplomatic solution, military options are not unimaginable.
Many people have talked about military options with words like unimaginable. And I would probably shift that slightly and say it would be horrific. And there would be a loss of life unlike any we have experienced in our lifetimes. And I mean anyone who's been alive since World War II has never seen the loss of life that could occur if there's a conflict on the Korean Peninsula. But as I've told my counterparts, both friend and foe, it is not unimaginable to have military options to respond to North Korean nuclear capability. What's unimaginable to me is allowing a capability that will allow a nuclear weapon to land in Denver, Colorado. That's unimaginable to me.
Strategic risk management consultant and former Air Force intelligence officer Cedric Layton says in this case, a credible military threat may be crucial in finding a diplomatic resolution.
Anytime that there are military solutions, military options being contemplated, you cannot pull the military options off the table if you're going to have effective diplomatic negotiations. So it becomes very critical for the United States to make it clear to any interlocutor like North Korea that the military option is always a possibility. The specific nature of that military option is something that is really something that remains to be determined based on not only what the capacity of the United States is, but also what the willingness of the administration would be to actually do something that would take the North Korean missile program out from under the central government in Pyongyang.
As a former Air Force intelligence officer, how good is our intelligence vis-a-vis North Korea's possible threat?
We have what amounts to very concrete coverage of North Korea. However, there are a lot of weaknesses, and even after 60 years of following the North Koreans and trying to follow their every move, it is very clear that there are significant gaps and remain significant gaps in our ability to consistently surveil the northern part of the Korean Peninsula. So there are gaps in the intelligence. There are certain weaknesses in our collection posture, particularly on the human intelligence side, that could not be remedied in the short term.
Sidgwick Layton also said he's not surprised Hawaiians are preparing for a potential North Korean missile strike. He noted historically that in 1941, no one thought the Japanese would attack Pearl Harbor in Hawaii. These are among some of the top Asia stories trending on VOAnews.com. At least 26 killed in Lahore blast. Trial of three Myanmar journalists marred by lack of access and transparency. Japan's Prime Minister Abe faces parliament grilling after support drops further. Philippines pokes China with intent to drill for oil in disputed sea. China says India must pull back its troops amid a border standoff. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are found on Facebook at VOA Asia. Also, stop by our VOAnews.com website. VOA Asia continues. North Korea has so far not responded to a South Korean offer made earlier this week to engage in military talks, the first formal overture by South Korea and its new president, Moon Jae-in. North Korea has also ignored or rejected a proposal to hold a reunion of families separated during the Korean War and offers of humanitarian aid. I spoke with VOA Seoul correspondent Brian Padden, who tells us about yet another group seeking engagement with the North. Families seeking information on relatives allegedly abducted by the North following the Korean War. He says some even want President Trump to pressure the North for answers.
It's easy to kind of write off this kind of out-of-the-ordinary request, but it does speak to the level of pain and frustration that these people are going through.
We have heard so much through the years about the family reunions between the South and the North, the few times that they've been able to actually cross the border and see loved ones who were separated by the war. But in the case of abductees, the information must be so difficult for them to obtain, if at all.
Exactly. And that's one of the frustrations that the abductees have, is that they see some of these family reunions happening. And in some cases, I've been told that some of the abductees were put on the list of family reunions, which they say, this is not for us. We're not talking about families that were separated. We're talking about family members who were taken. And so they don't want this treated as kind of an unfortunate separation. They still want this treated as a crime. And so that there's that other issue at play that makes it more difficult, that because it's a little easier for South Korea and North Korea to talk about the unfortunate separation of families and perhaps arranging some sort of temporary reunion for these families. It's another thing to say, you stole our people, and we want them back. North Korea has denied that they've taken these people, and that they deny that there's anybody who lives in this, you know, this workers' paradise of theirs that doesn't want to be there. So it puts another level of complexity to the issue.
And as you mentioned, I mean, this whole population of people involved is becoming quite old at this point, and many have died out. And it almost seems like it's a situation where the North is just kind of waiting for it to literally die out.
It seems like that. And that's the other issue you're dealing here with the separation and the division of the Korean Peninsula, is that where this was one country that was separated with strong ties between families and shared memories. That, too, this is another sign as years go by that there's less and less connection between the North and the South.
Is there any indication that perhaps the younger generations are looking for family histories and, like you mentioned earlier, trying to get remains of loved ones?
I think that's part of the frustration of these abductee families, is that part of it is they're not connecting at all with the younger generation. The younger generation does not have any interest in finding out about connections with North Korea or looking forward to unification. They actually just see this as just a strange, different world up in North, and they're very involved with their own lives here, and it's not, the North Korea issue no longer resonates with the young people in a way that it has, that it does with the older generation.
Well, very touching story, a heart-wrenching story, and we thank you, Brian Padden, our correspondent in Seoul, for bringing this to us.
Thank you, Jim.
Happening now in Asia, the Philippines' militant crisis in Marawi enters its third month, with more than 500 people dead so far, including 45 civilians. Government forces are fighting several militant groups, some with alleged ties to Islamic State. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. We're very glad to have you with us today on VOA Asia. Thank you for listening. Plans in the Philippines to reopen a tract of the disputed South China Sea for oil and gas exploration are likely to complicate the foreign policy of Manila's new friend, Beijing, which claims the same waters and adds to a regional pushback against Chinese maritime influence. Domestic news reports say the Philippine Department of Energy is ready to restart drilling at Reed Bank, a more than 8,800 square kilometer table mount west of Palawan Island. In December 2014, the government suspended those plans to prepare for world court arbitration over which country had a stronger claim to the feature. That court in The Hague ruled that Reed Bank falls within the Philippine Ocean Exclusive Economic Zone. China rejected the outcome and in May warned Philippine President Rodrigo Duterte against reopening it for exploration. China claims more than 90% of the sea, and as Carl Thayer, Southeast Asia Specialized Emeritus Professor at the University of New South Wales in Australia, points out, the ruling anniversary is a sensitive time.
You have Duterte saying he spoke to Xi Jinping in May and trying to threaten to take action if they started drilling. It's a sensitive time. July 12th was the first anniversary of the arbitral tribunal decision.
This month, Ismael Ocampo, director with the Department of Energy's Resource Development Bureau, said he expected the country to lift the drilling suspension by December. The department did not answer a VOA request for comment. Chinese officials have kept quiet about Reed Bank this month, although on July 12th, a foreign ministry spokesman in Beijing said China was dedicated from start to finish to negotiating with related countries to resolve disputes related to maritime sovereignty. Fabrizio Buzzato, a Taiwan Strategy Research Association fellow specialized in Asian political issues, says the Philippines may be using Reed Bank to see how far it can push China. Experts like Yuan Graham, International Security Director with the Lowy Institute for International Policy in Sydney, point to Vietnam's agreement this month with India's offshore oil and gas driller to explore a tract that Beijing claims, and to Indonesia's deletion of the word China from its official name of the sea near the island of Borneo.
I think the worst-case scenario is that the Southeast Asians divided, look over their shoulder, and one by one start making their accommodations with China. We're not seeing that when it comes to these key countries, Indonesia, Philippines, certainly the Vietnamese are continuing, I think, their sort of steady push to try and assert control.
He says China might answer any drilling at Reed Bank by withholding aid or investment as promised or allocated to date, hurting Duterte's ambition for economic development. Chinese officials could restart any suspended aid if relations improved. China pledged $24 billion for the Philippines in October, and Duterte's government set aside the maritime sovereignty dispute with China, which claims waters off of most of his archipelago's west coasts. Brunei, Malaysia, Taiwan, and Vietnam also claim parts of the 3.5 million square kilometer South China Sea, which is prized largely for its oil and gas reserves. The research institution's social weather stations found fewer than half of Filipinos surveyed in the first quarter of 2017 trust China, and analysts say Duterte must bear that in mind as an elected official. Our thanks to Ralph Jennings in Taipei for contributing this story. You're listening to VOA Asia.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's at voanews.com.
voanews.com.
Online news for a changing world.
This news alert from VOA Asia. Chinese Foreign Minister Wang Yi met with his Thai counterpart in Bangkok to discuss deepening ties through a key railway project, which is expected to link the industrial east with southern China through Laos. All the big stories come your way throughout the day on VOA Asia Facebook. This is VOA Asia. We continue now with VOA Asia. In education, the achievement gap is defined as the persistently low scores disadvantaged children get on tests when compared to their middle and upper class peers. It has economic and racial components, and educators have been battling to solve the problem for decades. VOA's Kevin Enix reports some research done with low-income kids in India is providing some clues that may help close the gap.
These low-income preschool kids in India are playing games, but they're also learning math. Researchers from India and the United States designed these games in the hopes of closing the education gap between rich and poor kids in India and around the world.
Key problems that children face when they reach the middle of primary schools is that the curriculum is such that teachers are compelled to teach to the top of the classrooms because the curriculums are very demanding.
Over time, kids who are a little bit behind become further and further behind.
And as a result, what happens very quickly in primary school is kids get lost, they stop paying attention, they get promoted from class to class, and they reach the end of primary school with essentially very little knowledge.
These games are designed to help put rich and poor kids on the same level when they first hit the classroom.
We designed two different sets of games for kids to play. The main intervention was a set of math games where kids were encouraged to exercise their intuitive abilities in number and geometry.
The kids loved the games, but did they work?
And we found that children who had played the math games had significant improvements in their intuitive concepts of mathematics, both geometry and number comparisons. They also showed some improvement even in symbolic skills, such as recognizing numbers and things like that.
The researchers also learned that there are simple, inexpensive ways to give disadvantaged kids new skills.
The kinds of activities that we developed for children in India are just the kinds of activities that excite children in Cambridge, Massachusetts.
The downside is that those gains didn't necessarily translate to the classroom, perhaps because of the differences between game learning and classroom learning. The researchers are now working on innovative ways to solve that problem. Kevin Enix, VOA News.
Developing at this hour in Asia, Indonesian President Joko Widodo has instructed law enforcement to shoot drug traffickers. Drawing comparisons with the bloody anti-drugs war waged by Philippines President Rodrigo Duterte. This story and more on today's VOA 60. Visit VOA Asia Facebook daily for fun features. This is VOA Asia. Now on VOA Asia, many people enjoy a cup of coffee. Maybe you do too, especially in the morning. Well, it turns out that this is giving everyone who does that a good start, not just to their day, but to their overall lives. A new study shows coffee may help you live longer. It indicates that people who drink at least 3 cups of the beverage each day appear to live longer than those who don't. In the largest study on coffee drinking so far, scientists examined data from 500,000 healthy people over the age of 35 in 10 European countries. VOA's Deborah Block has brewed more for us.
For 20 years, this coffee lab has sourced, tested, and supplied beans to customers. During that time, there have been contradictory studies about coffee's impact on people's health. Now, researchers from the International Agency for Research on Cancer and the Imperial College London have discovered that coffee consumption is associated with a reduced risk of death, especially from circulatory and digestive tract diseases.
We found that the same results in 10 European countries, and for a different type of coffee consumed, from the espresso to the Norwegian filter coffee, came out as associated with reduced mortality in these different populations.
Men who drank at least 3 cups a day were 18% less likely to die than non-coffee drinkers. For women, it was 7%. Stephen Hurst works for a coffee company.
I don't know why, going back some years, that coffee had negative connotations, so I'm very pleased to see the playing field being leveled out a little bit.
But skeptics say a number of key factors are not considered in the report. They point out, for example, that people who were not healthy are not part of the study, and that coffee drinkers may just be healthier to begin with. Deborah Block, VOA News, Washington.
In recent months, Silicon Valley has been shaken over bias and harassment allegations raised by women in the industry. High-profile executives have left their firms, including Uber's CEO. VOA's Dina Mitchell reports from San Mateo, California. The controversy casts a shadow over a unique part of the U.S. tech industry, the startup ecosystem.
This is no normal workout. More than 30 female venture capitalists, lawyers, and business leaders took part in an indoor cycling event to try to raise awareness about a problem that many feel has long been overlooked in Silicon Valley: how male venture capitalists perceive and treat female startup founders and employees. The Spinning as Protest is the brainchild of Tim Draper, a prominent venture capitalist.
This is an exciting time for women, and I'm all for it, and let's go. Let's start businesses. There's no glass ceiling if you start your own business.
I think men have to be very important champions for women empowerment, because the reality is that most decision makers today on the top, political business leaders, are men. So they have to be part of the change.
Many women in Silicon Valley are telling their stories about gender-based discrimination faced when pitching ideas to venture capitalists, who are almost always men, and harassment they've received in a male-dominated industry.
You pitch your idea, and they go, oh, that's really interesting, and it was more like they were just setting up dates.
Dent, a former model turned tech entrepreneur, says she faced harassment during conversations with a would-be advisor.
What was I going to do, go to the police?
Dent, instead, focused on Cinemerse, the app she was creating for smartwatches.
I fell deeply into a hole and didn't know what to do, and I learned to code. I decided, he's not going to win.
The willingness of more women to publicly come forward, talking publicly and posting their experiences on social media, is making an impact on the venture capital industry. In the case of Uber, the company's financial backers ultimately pressed for the ousting of the CEO.
Can use things like social media now and other many outlets we have, not just the courts, to communicate what we're all seeing within the industry, and I think that's one of the biggest changes.
By taking to social media, women are using technology to change the social construct of the tech world. Dina Mitchell in San Mateo, California, for VOA News.
Well, the tech world certainly includes iTunes and SoundCloud. That's where you can find our program to download. You can also find us on VOA Asia Facebook and at our website, voanews.com. Plus, we'd like you to use a little bit of tech and let us hear from you. You can send us a message via Facebook or just an email. voaasia@voanews.com is our address. We also like to thank everybody listening to VOA Asia in China and Taiwan. On the voice of Chung Rung, Star Radio FM 88.3 at Chung Rung Christian University. Thank you so much for joining us. Our director is Tracy Carter, engineer Dan Crafton. Managing Editor Diane Gao, Ali Ogden, and David Byrd, part of our VOA Asia team as well. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. We hope you have a great day ahead.